Imagine you have a device in your pocket that uses less power than a standard light bulb, yet it can somehow directly whisper to a tennis court-sized satellite flying like 17,000 miles an hour above your head.
Right.
Today, I mean, that isn't a science fiction concept anymore. It is happening right now, and it is completely rewriting the rules of global communication.
Yeah, it really forces us to entirely rethink what is possible when technology actually scales. Because, you know, we tend to assume that as tech gets bigger and more advanced, it universally becomes cheaper, faster, more accessible for everyone.
Exactly.
But the reality playing out across industries right now is, well, it's far more complicated than that.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today is Wednesday, June 17, 2026. We are looking at a really fascinating stack of notes from the Tech & Night newsletter, and our mission is to unpack a truly historic 24 hours in technology.
And it really has been a historic day.
Yeah. We are talking about massive structural shifts in how technology survives when it gets unimaginably huge. We're going to explore the, frankly, ruthless economic realities currently reshaping the gaming industry, the sudden democratization of physical space infrastructure, and, well, the shocking overnight end of the Western AI monopoly. So let's jump in.
The common thread you will see across all these sources is the mechanism of scale. We are watching established giants stumble under the crushing weight of their own massive investments, while incredibly agile underdogs are using open ecosystems to scale in ways we didn't think were physically or economically possible just a decade ago.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with what can only be described as a devastating day for the gaming community.
Yeah, it's rough.
Microsoft has just confirmed active negotiations to either close or spin off some of their most beloved, critically acclaimed first-party development studios. We are talking about Ninja Theory,
right.
You know, the creators of the Hellblade series, Double Fine, the brilliant minds behind Psychonauts, and Compulsion Games.
All right.
And the timing here is just brutal. This news drops exactly 9 days after these exact studios were on stage at the Xbox Game Showcase.
Unbelievable.
Right. You have developers who pulled all-nighters to get those gameplay trailers ready for massive applause, and now they are suddenly polishing their resumes.
It is an incredibly stark pivot. I mean, remember, these are studios Microsoft intentionally acquired to be the prestige wing of Xbox Game Studios. They were bought to bolster the creative portfolio with diverse, narrative-driven art.
Which makes this so jarring. To put this in perspective for you, the listener, this feels like a major Hollywood studio buying up brilliant Oscar-winning indie film directors, putting them on staff, and then abruptly firing them because they aren't churning out like billion-dollar superhero blockbusters.
It's actually a really good analogy.
Because these studios make phenomenal art. Psychonauts 2 and Hellblade both have Metacritic scores hovering right around a 90. So help me understand the actual financial logic behind shutting down teams universally recognized for making great games.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the answer lies in a single massive number, $68.7 billion.
Wow.
Yeah. That is what Microsoft paid to acquire Activision Blizzard. And when you execute an acquisition of that magnitude, the corporate physics of your company fundamentally change. You are no longer operating in a space where prestige or critical acclaim pays the bills.
Right, because of the debt.
Exactly. You are operating under the immense pressure of Wall Street analysts demanding a return on a nearly $70 billion bet.
Meaning the sheer scale of the debt dictates the type of product you are allowed to make.
Precisely that. Let's look at the math for what the industry called duet-scale games.
Mm-hmm.
A studio like Ninja Theory might spend $30 to $60 million to make a gorgeous narrative masterpiece like Hellblade II.
Okay.
Let's say it sells 2 to 3 million copies at $50 each. You are looking at $100 to $150 million in revenue.
Which sounds like a massive success for a single piece of media.
In isolation, it absolutely is. But in the context of Microsoft, we have to talk about opportunity cost. Microsoft's gaming division is generating about $21.5 billion in revenue right now.
Right.
They now own Call of Duty, a franchise that generates over $3 billion annually on its own. So tying up a team of 200 incredibly talented developers for 4 years to make a single-player game that generates a one-time burst of $150 million, it's now seen as a misallocation of capital.
Because they could be doing something else.
Exactly. Because those same 200 developers could theoretically be deployed to build a live service game that generates monthly recurring revenue for a decade.
Which brings up Microsoft's intended golden goose, Xbox Game Pass. The sources note that EA Sports FC 26 is dropping on Game Pass, perfectly timed with the 2026 World Cup.
Yeah, huge move.
But I have to push back on this strategy bit. Microsoft is paying astronomical sums to EA and other publishers to put these massive franchises on the service, all to justify a $17 a month subscription. Are they building the next Netflix, where sheer volume covers the content cost? Or is this the next MoviePass, where the fundamental unit economics are just a fantasy?
That is the multi-billion dollar tension at the heart of the industry right now. So Microsoft has roughly 25 million Game Pass subscribers. At $17 a month, you are looking at roughly $5.1 billion in annual revenue.
But $5.1 billion doesn't go very far when you are putting brand new $70 AAA games on the service on day one. I mean, you are paying third-party publishers, funding global server infrastructure, and paying thousands of internal developers.
Right, that revenue gets eaten up incredibly fast, which is why the entire industry is shifting toward games as a service, or GaaS.
Like Fortnite.
Yeah, exactly. A game like Fortnite doesn't charge you up front, you know? It generates recurring revenue for years through microtransactions. Single-player, highly authored experiences, the exact game studios like Double Fine specialize in, do not drive that kind of long-tail recurring revenue.
So they just don't fit the model anymore.
Right. So Microsoft is adapting to its own massive size by sacrificing its creative middle class to bet everything on massive franchise tentpoles.
So Microsoft is locking down content into a massive, closed, subscription walled garden just to survive the brutal economics of scale.
Yeah.
But what's fascinating is that if you look out to orbit, another company is using a totally open, partnership-based model to scale physical infrastructure in a way that seems almost impossible.
The space internet story.
Yes. Let's talk about the Tech and Night dispatch from the pre-dawn hours today. At 2:39 a.m., SpaceX launched three massive Block 2 Bluebird satellites for a company called AST SpaceMobile. The goal is to bring high-speed 4G and 5G internet to the 5.6 billion addressable mobile users globally, targeting completely unserved rural regions.
And the crucial detail here is they're doing this without requiring the user to buy any new equipment.
Right, and here's where it gets really interesting, because I have to question the physics of how this actually works.
Okay.
I know the mechanics of Starlink. If you want Starlink, you have to buy a $599 specialized phased array dish. You mount a serious piece of hardware on your roof to talk to space.
Yep.
How on earth can my standard unmodified smartphone, which pumps out less than 1 watt of power, somehow connect to a satellite flying 500 kilometers away in low Earth orbit?
Your skepticism is totally warranted because your phone is incredibly weak. The solution is that if the phone is weak, the satellite has to do all the heavy lifting. We're not talking about standard bus-sized satellites here.
Okay.
Each Block 2 Bluebird unfolds a deployable phased array antenna that is 10 by 10 meters in size.
So essentially a tennis court floating in orbit.
Exactly. It is the largest commercial communications antenna ever placed in space. But it's the phased array part that makes the physics work.
How so?
It doesn't just act like a giant dumb funnel collecting radio waves. A phased array uses hundreds of small individual antennas. Hmm. By slightly delaying the signal between those tiny antennas by fractions of a nanosecond, they create an interference pattern.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they essentially steer the radio waves electronically without any physical moving parts. They can actively focus a microscopic, highly sensitive beam directly onto your specific cell phone, filtering out the background noise of the entire planet.
So the satellite is dynamically shifting its focus to isolate that 1 watt signal from my phone.
Yeah.
How much coverage can one of these tennis courts actually handle at once?
Because of that extreme beamforming, a single Bluebird satellite can manage 3,000 to 5,000 simultaneous active connections. And the footprint of that single satellite covers an area of roughly 200,000 square kilometers.
That is an area the size of the entire state of Nebraska.
Yes.
Covered by one single piece of hardware.
And this brings us back to the economics of scale. AST SpaceMobile isn't trying to build a walled garden or compete with your cell provider. They are partnering with AT&T, Verizon, and Vodafone. Think about the physical constraints of a telecom company down here. Building a single traditional cell tower in a remote area costs between $150,000 and $500,000, and it only covers a few miles.
So rather than laying fiber optics and pouring concrete across rural mountains, AT&T essentially just rents space on the Bluebird satellite to wholesale the connectivity.
Exactly.
It completely flips the economics of telecommunications on its head.
We are effectively treating low Earth orbit like a standard everyday extension of our terrestrial cell network. It's just a cell tower moving at 17,000 miles an hour.
But treating space like everyday infrastructure creates a glaring new problem. Down here on Earth, if a cell tower breaks, you send a technician up a ladder in a van to fix it.
Right.
What happens when your multi-million-dollar tennis court-sized space infrastructure starts breaking down?
Historically, well, it just became space junk. But that paradigm is shifting rapidly, as we see with the unfolding situation regarding NASA's Swift Observatory.
Yeah, the Swift-based telescope is an absolute veteran. It launched in 2004, so it's 22 years old, and it has detected over 1,700 gamma-ray bursts, you know, the most violent explosions in the universe.
It's an amazing piece of tech.
But Swift currently has a critical problem. It is physically falling out of orbit.
And it isn't falling due to a mechanical failure. It is falling because of space weather.
Space weather?
Yeah, we are currently at the peak of solar cycle 25. Every 11 years or so, the sun becomes highly active, releasing frequent solar flares and coronal mass ejections. All of this intense solar energy bombards the Earth's upper atmosphere, the thermosphere, and significantly heats it up.
And basic physics dictates that when gases heat up, they expand.
Exactly. The atmosphere literally puffs outward. Because Swift sits in low Earth orbit, roughly 600 kilometers up, this expanding atmosphere is suddenly engulfing the telescope, creating massive friction.
Oh, I see.
The atmospheric drag on Swift has increased by 300 to 500%. And the telescope has no onboard propulsion system to push itself back up. It is entirely passive.
So it's stuck.
Right. So it is currently losing 2 to 3 kilometers of altitude every single month, essentially being dragged down to burn up in the atmosphere.
Unless we step in. And NASA is stepping in by deploying a spacecraft called LINC, built by a private company, Catalyst Space Technologies.
Yes.
Now, reading through the mission profile in the notes, I had this thought. Are we basically dispatching an autonomous robotics-based tow truck to jumpstart a 22-year-old sports car while it is hurtling down the highway at orbital velocity?
That is pretty much exactly what is happening.
But wait, pulling a car on a highway is one thing. How do you physically grapple a tumbling, fragile space telescope with giant glass solar panels in a zero-gravity vacuum without just smashing it to pieces?
What's fascinating here is the sheer precision engineering required to make your tow truck analogy a reality. The LINC spacecraft doesn't even launch vertically. It is air-launched. Yeah, it gets carried up under a modified L-1011 airplane, drops, and its Pegasus XL rocket ignites to take it to orbit. Once it arrives, it uses advanced computer vision to autonomously approach Swift. It has to calculate and perfectly match the exact spin rate and tumble of the 22-year-old telescope.
So it has to dance with it before it can grab it.
Precisely. Once the motion is synchronized, LINC uses robotic arms to gently latch onto the reinforced structural ring of Swift, avoiding those fragile solar panels you mentioned.
Okay, that makes sense.
And once securely attached, LINC doesn't just slam on the gas. It extremely slowly and carefully fires its own thrusters, acting as an external engine, to gently push the combined mass 100 kilometers higher into a safe, stable orbit.
Wow. It is literally orbital maintenance as a service.
And the economic driver here is crucial. This is only happening because the cost of getting to orbit has absolutely plummeted. During the space shuttle era, a launch costs roughly $450 million.
Right.
Today, a SpaceX Falcon 9 launch costs around $67 million. Because that barrier to entry drops so drastically, you can now have private startups offering routine orbital maintenance. Space is becoming mundane infrastructure, and ironically, its mundanity is what makes it revolutionary.
A massive plunge in the cost of access completely democratized space overnight. And looking at the next story in our stack, it seems a similar plunge in computational cost just democratized artificial intelligence in the exact same way.
It really did.
We are looking at twin bombshells dropping out of China that completely upend the AI hierarchy. Let's start with the big one. A Chinese AI company called Z.AI just released a model called GLM 5.2.
Yep.
And the benchmark scores, which are verified by MIT and Stanford, show that GLM 5.2 just beat OpenAI's flagship GPT 5.5 on the Frontier SW benchmark. The score was 74.4 to 73.4.
And just for context, Frontier SWE is the absolute gold standard test for autonomous complex software engineering. It tests whether an AI can act as an independent software engineer, not just a smart autocomplete.
Beating OpenAI on that benchmark is huge, but the kicker is the price tag. GLM 5.2 costs just 5.86 per million tokens.
Mm-hmm.
Compare that to GPT 5.5, which costs $35 per million tokens.
Incredible.
It is doing superior engineering work for 1/6 of the price. And GLM 5.2 also boasts a 1 million token context window. To translate that for you, a 1 million token window means this AI can hold and process about 15 to 20 medium-sized software repositories in its working memory, all at the exact same time.
Which changes everything.
Yeah, you can ask it to find a cascading bug hidden across 20 different code bases, and it can just analyze the entire architecture at once.
That completely evaporates the pricing power that Western companies like OpenAI have relied on. If you are an enterprise company using AI to write code, your fundamental unit economics just improved by a factor of 6.
But the second bombshell is almost weirder and highly disruptive. Just hours after GLM 5.2 was announced, the Chinese tech giant Weibo dropped a model called VibeThinker 3B.
Right.
The 3B stands for 3 billion parameters. In the frontier AI world, a 3 billion parameter model is microscopic. Yet on the AIMEE 2026 benchmark, which is a brutally difficult mathematical reasoning test, this tiny model matched the performance of a 671 billion parameter giant. It did the complex reasoning of a supercomputer. But it is small enough that you can download it and run it entirely offline, completely privately, on a standard consumer laptop with 16 gigabytes of RAM.
It represents a stunning leap in algorithmic optimization.
So what does this all mean? Because I have to play devil's advocate here.
Sure.
When a model that tiny is suddenly acing a test designed for supercomputers, are we actually measuring real intelligence? Or have these small models just been heavily trained to perfectly memorize the answer key to these specific standardized tests? Are they just teaching to the test?
This raises an important question, and it is the exact debate currently dominating the AI research community. Many critics argue that these benchmarks are simply saturated and that a 3 billion parameter model must be gaming the system. However, the researchers at Weibo anticipated this skepticism. To prove VibeThinker possesses genuine reasoning abilities, they subjected it to unseen, highly complex leak code programming contests that were published to the internet after the model's training data was locked.
So there is absolute certainty the model couldn't have memorized the answers. It had to figure them out live.
Exactly.
And it achieved a 96.1% acceptance rate on those completely unseen problems. How does a tiny model actually do that?
Well, it achieves this through a mechanism called verifiable reasoning with diversity-driven optimization.
That sounds complicated.
It's basically a new approach. Older generation models basically just guessed the next most statistically likely word. But VibeThinker is trained to generate multiple highly diverse logical pathways to solve a single problem.
Okay.
It then uses a built-in verification mechanism to step-by-step check its own math and logic across those different pathways. It actively discards the flawed logic and only presents the most mathematical sound path. Yeah, it isn't a general intelligence like if you ask it to write a creative novel, it will struggle. But for pure logical reasoning, it is a razor-sharp, specialized tool.
This shift feels monumental for the global balance of power. The U.S. has spent the last few years aggressively utilizing trade embargoes to block China from getting the advanced microchips, you know, like high-end GPUs, needed to train massive AI models.
And based on the data in these sources, that embargo strategy has fundamentally failed to maintain a technological moat.
Really?
Yeah. The assumption was that without access to massive server farms of the absolute latest hardware, Chinese AI progress would hit a wall. Instead, Chinese researchers pivoted. Because they were starved of hardware, they focused relentlessly on algorithmic efficiency, architectural innovations, and what are known as open weights strategies.
What does an open weights strategy actually entail?
Instead of a company keeping their incredibly smart AI locked behind a paid server API, they publish the underlying neural network parameters, the weights of the model, to the public for free.
Oh, so anyone can use it.
Yes. This allows the entire global developer community to download it, tinker with it, optimize it, and improve it collaboratively. By leveraging the collective brain power of the global open source community, they bypassed hardware bottlenecks through pure collaborative algorithmic efficiency.
Wow.
The era of a Western AI monopoly is definitively over. The AI race is now a multipolar marathon with several highly capable runners competing fiercely on cost and efficiency.
We are looking at a tech landscape currently defined by absolute extremes. On one hand, you have massive corporate consolidation in the gaming industry where creative diversity is being sacrificed just to survive the crushing economics of multi-billion dollar scale.
Right.
But simultaneously, the tools of creation are being radically democratized. The physical infrastructure of space and the frontiers of artificial intelligence are becoming incredibly cheap and accessible to everyone.
Exactly. The center is consolidating, but the edges are rapidly expanding.
Which brings up a fascinating final thought for you to mull over. Think about how these seemingly disparate stories from the Tikken Knight stack actually overlap. We just established that AI, like Vibepinger 3B, is now capable of supercomputer-level reasoning while being small enough to run locally, for free, on a standard cheap laptop.
Yeah.
And we established that AST SpaceMobile is deploying orbital arrays that can beam high-speed internet directly to unmodified devices anywhere on the planet. What happens when we combine them?
It's a crazy thought.
Imagine the 5.6 billion people in previously unserved remote regions suddenly having localized, ultra-genius AI right on their devices, instantly synced and connected to the global economy via satellite. How does the global balance of innovation change when the next world-altering technological breakthrough doesn't come from a multi-billion-dollar Silicon Valley server farm, but from a cheap laptop in a rural village?
It completely decentralizes the future of human ingenuity.
It really does. It is a wild time to be paying attention. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the forces shaping our world. Keep your eyes on the stars and your models running locally. We'll catch you next time.